sponsored by Yaakov and Atar Serel in honor of their son Mordechai's graduation from Columbia Law School. Mazel tov to them. Their son Yehuda's upcoming wedding to Miriam Kelly, and their daughter Chana and Dovi Chaitovsky's return from Eretz Yisrael, their son Shmuel's return from Chafetz Chaim, Miami, their daughter Esther's graduation from Sheva High School and acceptance to Hadar Seminary. That's all in one sponsorship. I think that is the record. Yeah, it should. Arguably, one of the worst kings that we've ever had was Menashe. Menashe incorporated not only did he involve himself in Avodah Zarah, he made it an official function of the government to spread the worship of idols, and his personality was powerful, the mechanism of government spread it, and he brought the entire Jewish nation to a very, very low level. As a matter of fact, he was so wicked that the Mishnah in Sanhedrin lists three kings who have no chelik in Olam Haba, no portion in the world to come. One of them is Menashe. Interestingly enough, when Rav Ashi was teaching the Mishnah, he got up to that very statement and it was time to end the shiur for that day, at which point Rav Ashi said as follows, L'mochar, tomorrow, niftach b'chavrayim. Tomorrow we'll begin discussing our friends. He did not mean that facetiously. Rashi explains what Rav Ashi was saying is, tomorrow we'll discuss those Talmidei Chachamim who are on our level, on the same level as we are, and yet they have no chelik in the world to come. With those words, Rav Ashi ended the shir. The Gemara tells us, Menashe came to Rav Ashi in a dream that night. And Menashe said to him as follows, you're calling me and my father your friend? You're implying that we're on your level? He then asked Rav Ashi a question in halacha. You claim we're on the same level, let me ask you a question, says Menashe. And he asks Rav Ashi a question in halacha. And Rav Ashi said, I do not know the answer. Furthermore, says Rav Ashi, if you'll tell me though, what the halacha is, I'll say it over in your name. Menashe says, you call us your friends and you don't even know the answer to that, I'll tell you the answer. And at which point Menashe told Rav Ashi the answer to this question. No sooner did Menashe say that than Rav Ashi turned to him and said as follows, if you're so wise, why is it that you followed Avodah Zarah? If you clearly know so much, I thought you were on my madrega, I thought you were on my level, I'm mistaken. Really, you're far above it. If so, why were you so mistaken? Why did you serve idols? Amalei, Menashe said back, Ilahavis Kaman, had you been there, you would have picked up the cloak of your skirt. You would have picked up your cloak to run after Avodah Zarah. That's why I did it. L'mocha, the next day, when Rav Ashi began the shir, Amalu l'Rabbanan, he said to the Rabbanan, Niftach b'Rabusa, let me begin discussing our Rebbeim, those who are greater than us. And he began with those three who have no chelik, those three kings who have no portion in the world to come, one of them being Menashe. And this is the Gemara. And this Gemara seems to be a very interesting indication to the level of Menashe and to a interesting discussion that Rav Ashi had with him. But here's a question I'd like to pose to you. In Shema, twice a day, we say the words, L'sasur achrei levavchem v'achrei einechem. There is a specific commandment not to follow your heart, nor to follow your desires, your eyes. Now, typically, we understand this as two separate categories. L'sasur achrei levavchem means do not serve idols, don't believe in false beliefs, do not follow apikorsus or minas. Those are what we call sins of belief, sins of understanding. Los asur achare nechem, don't follow after your eyes, are sins of passion. Don't be pulled after lust, don't be pulled after desire. But those are two separate categories. Levavchem refers to those sins of understanding, of belief. Achare nechem refers to sins of passion, of desire. Now let's understand clearly what's going on here. What Menashe was guilty of was clearly a sin of understanding. You do not worship Avodah Zarah, you do not serve idols if you don't fully, firmly believe in them. What that means in plain simple language is that his flaw, his shortcoming, was in belief, in understanding. He believed that avodah zarah, that idols have a certain power. He believed in their significance, in their rule. But it wasn't a flaw of passion. If so, I understand very well Rav Ashi's kasha. You're brilliant. You understand halachas that even I don't. So how is it possible that you were so foolish as to believe in these idols having powers, being significant? How could you have done that? The question that Rav Ashi asked makes perfect sense. The problem is, what's the answer? It says Menashe, had you been alive in my generation, not only would have you have served idols, you would have pulled up your cloak to run after idols. And immediately Rav Ashi understood the answer. The problem is, it's not an answer. Rav Ashi understood how foolish it was. Rav Ashi understood how ridiculous the concept is. What would any difference have been had he been born in a different generation, had he been there at a time? What was Menashe's answer to him? And I'd like to spend some time this evening discussing this concept and discussing what we understand as belief and emunah in general. And let me begin with the following observation. Rav Chanan says that there is a mitzvah, the first mitzvah that the Rambam counts, for a person to believe in Hashem, to believe that Hashem is the cause of all creations. That is a full mitzvah say, to believe that Hashem created everything in this world. Rav Chanan asks the following question. That mitzvah is incumbent upon every Jew, a girl at the age of 12, a boy at the age of 13. Ask Rav Chanan the following question. How could the Torah possibly obligate a young child in a mitzvah that is so difficult to accomplish? And he brings a proof to this. He says some of the greatest minds in history did not believe in Hashem. For instance, says Rav Chanan, the Rambam quotes that Aristotle was one of the most brilliant men who ever lived. The Rambam says that Aristotle reached just under Nevuah, the level of wisdom right under prophecy. He understood, he was brilliant, he had a worldview, and yet the Rambam points out that Aristotle remained an Epicurus to the end of his days, did not believe in Hashem. So if a man as brilliant, as wise, as intelligent as Aristotle did not believe in Hashem, how could you possibly obligate a mere child to believe, to understand things that some of the greatest minds in history have not understood? And that is Rav Chanan's question. And his answer basically is that we make a certain mistake. We assume that the head and the heart are two separate organs. One does not affect the other. But the reality is, what you desire, what interests you, what you're seeking greatly affects your understanding and your beliefs. And I'd like to share with you exactly what he means. I had a conversation a while back with a young man who's going out with a woman, and he needed to speak to me, very important. I said, gladly, sure, what he's doing. He said, I went out four times, and I really enjoy the conversations, and she's a very attractive young woman, and I'm really very interested. I said, oh, great, sounds wonderful. What's the problem? And he said, well, and he began describing the spending habits of this young woman, the coach. Pocketbooks, the three different knockout outfits she wore on one Shabbos, and it was very clear that he was going to get himself into a bad situation because there's no way he could afford her spending habits. I'm not sure if anyone could. I didn't say anything at that point. But then he began to describe another part of the problem. The next part of the problem was that they fight regularly. Regularly they're getting into fights. And I was wondering, four dates, maybe you got a couple of phone calls in between, but how much time exactly do you have to fight? But he says, we're getting into regular fights. Okay. And as a matter of fact, he said over to me on one phone call, it was one phone call conversation, and I overheard her speak to another person, and she was rude and nasty and downright obnoxious. Now, at this point, the question is beginning to cease to exist in my mind. But then he went on a little bit further, describing who she is and how she behaves. And I really didn't quite understand it. And then he got to the more interesting part. He describes that the friend of this young woman is actually a very nice person. And she's really a wonderful person. And he begins describing this other girl and describes in very glowing terms. As I said to him, you know something? It sounds to me that the young woman you're going out with is not the one you should be interested in. It's the other one. Why are you going out with this one? Why don't you go out with the other one? And he said the following words. the young woman I'm going out with, if she would find out that I went out with her friend, there would be no trace left. Not a trace in history. She would kill everyone. At which point I said these words, is this the woman you would like to have as the mother of your children? No. Is this the woman you'd like your children to be like? No. So what's your question? So he said, well, everybody can change, right? Now, it took me not a long time to try to explain to him that she ain't going to change. But what do you think the odds are that he's going to marry her? I don't know. And would you like to know why? It's really quite simple. She's very attractive, very charming, and he's fallen for her. And despite the fact that he clearly gets it, he understands, and he said it back to me, I would never want this person to be the mother of my children. I would never want my children to be like that. Despite the fact that he clearly understands exactly the implications, at the same point, he's not quite sure he's ready to drop her. Why not? Because she can change. And I believe what you look at when you see this is a very clear example of a person's desires, a person's wants, changing their clear rational thinking to be absolutely mud. I was involved with a young man who brought the woman to our house when she first got engaged, and my wife was very sharp, said one line, there's something mysterious about her. My children loved her, she's very attractive, long hair, the kids were playing, but it was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. As it turned out, 2 years after that, when I was speaking to the young man and we were a bit involved in the issue over there, there was some physical abuse in the marriage. Now, keep in mind, he's 6'2", a big strapping guy, and she's a short little girl, and you hear about physical abuse, that's a very disheartening idea, except the problem was that she was beating him up. She would chase after him. He was a big, strong guy. He didn't want to touch her. He'd run away. She would chase him into the street, running after him to hit him. And you have to say, what was his problem? Didn't he see the signs? Didn't he understand what he was getting into? What was going on? And my friends, the answer is you could be brilliant. You could be insightful. You could see everything with a total, absolute clarity until you fall for her. And then you become blind, you become dumb, you can't see your nose in front of your face. And intelligent, thinking people make blunders, huge, huge mistakes, because their heart dramatically affects their thinking, their minds. And if you don't quite see it here, I think that's what Rav Elchanan says is exactly the answer. Rav Elchanan says, if you desire something, it will change not just your interests, it will change your very thought process. And he says it's quite simple. If a human being opens his eyes and looks at this world, the complexity, the systems, the harmonious, integrated, complex entities, each one working together, the wonder of every facet of creation screams out there's a creator. How could it be that people believe it just happened, it's just a lucky roll of the cosmic dice? For one reason, they wish not to see a creator. If there's a creator, then likely he wants things from me, he wants me to do certain things, not do certain things, and therefore because I don't want it, it blinds me, shapes my way of thinking, and will not allow me to see that which is clearly right in front of my eyes. It says Rav Elchanan, listen carefully to the language in Kriya Shema, Lo sasuru acharei levavchem. When the Torah says don't go after false ideologies, the Torah says didn't say don't follow your mind, don't believe in false concepts. The Torah said don't be pulled after your heart. Because even the concepts that a person believes in, his ideologies, his beliefs, are dramatically affected by his heart, by his desires. It says Rav Elchanan, that's actually the mitzvah of emunah. The mitzvah of belief is really quite simple. Put away your agenda, put away your interests, ask yourself one simple question, what do my eyes see? What does the world say to me? If you do that, you see Hashem vividly, palpably, right in front of your eyes, every moment of your life, every time you open a science textbook, every time you peer into any aspect of this creation, you see God. However, if you have a predetermination, I don't want to believe in God, because of whatever, because it's archaic, because it's limiting, and because I can't do things then, or I have to do things, then says Rabbi Hanan, all of the proofs in the world, belief after belief, will be just negated. You could bring that person the entire world. You could bring them every single proof. They don't want to see it. They don't want to believe. Hence, you'll never change their perspective, and they will not believe. And says Rabbi Hanan, that is the mitzvah of Emunah. Aristotle could blow it, not because he wasn't smart. He was brilliant. But he was pulled by his heart, by his desires. And what the Torah is saying to a young child, strip away your interest, your agenda, ask yourself what you see, and you'll see Hashem right there. Okay. Now, one more step that's very important for our long-term goal here. There is a famous chazal, the Mishagodol Mechaveru, Yitzro Godol Mechaveru. One who is greater than his friend, his Yetzahara is greater than his friend as well. Now, you're probably wondering about that chazal, that it makes very little sense. After all, we all know that the human, the I, have been comprised of two separate parts. In the Shmuz, we've discussed this quite a number of times. There's a nefesh abahami, a nefesh asichli. There's a nefesh within me that's pure instincts, drives, and desires. And there's also a different part of me that's pure seichel, pure intelligence that only wants to serve Hashem. The more I give into the behema, the more I give into those base desires and drives, the stronger it becomes. The more I resist and allow my seichel to win, the stronger it becomes. The more a person works on himself, the more a person grows, the more a person develops, the more their seichel, their intelligence comes to the fore, the weaker their behemoth becomes, and they grow level after level. Hence, the greater a person is, isn't it obvious that his Yetzirah is weaker? Isn't it obvious if your name is Ramosha Feinstein, your Yetzirah, your Nefesh Abahami is tiny, your Seichel is huge, and the normal desires of mankind won't pull you? Yet the Chazal are telling us the exact opposite. The greater a person is, the greater is his Yetzirah. And to understand this concept, I'd like to share with you what I consider a fundamental understanding of how Taiva works. If you note, in the springtime, May especially, the animal kingdom comes to life. The birds begin building nests, the beavers begin building dams, the entire animal kingdom springs into a new level of energy because they are preparing for the mating season. In the springtime, the mating urge is powerful. For months and months, a dog, a baboon, a cat will be just whatever. But at this point, come May and June, it's like they go into hyperdrive. There's an energy level. And if you have a dog, if you own a cat, you know that they'll dig their way out of anything you'll keep them in because they go into heat. And there's a huge, huge, powerful drive. A few months into the season, and it passes, and they still have something of a drive, but there's no comparison. The drive in the animal increases and decreases seasonally. During this period, it's very intense. The rest of the year, it's much weaker. Just like drives and desire can increase based on time of the year, there's a fascinating chazal that says that B'nai Yisrael, when they got to Shittim, a place called Shittim, they began being mezana, they began living with women, B'nos Moav, and women that they shouldn't have. Says the Medrash Tanchuma, why is it? Why is it Vayichal Am Liznos? Because says the Medrash Tanchuma, there are places that elicit a greater extent of taiva. There are places that Hashem put more passion in, more drive, more desire, and when you get to that place, it's sort of like if the normal set point of taiva is 10 or 15, it now boosts it up, it goes to 20, to 25, to 30. It's like you have a magnet, and now you put a little electrical charge, instead of being so magnetic, it's now much, much more magnetic. There are certain places that have a greater pull of taiva. I'm theorizing here for a moment, but it would not shock me if San Francisco was just such a place. Sometimes you have to wonder, why is it that certain locales just seem to be magnets for improper behavior? And I believe that certainly when Chazal described that's shittim, it would not shock me if there were certain places that have more of a pull, so that if a regular, ordinary person had a set point of 15 as taiva, he goes to that place, it increases, it's now 20, it's now 25, and he will do many things that he wouldn't do otherwise. Again, an electromagnet applied, electricity applied more and more. Now, one more step to understand exactly what happens. Let's imagine for a minute that you begin with a Nefesh HaBahami and a Nefesh HaSichli 50-50. You're a regular person and you're going about your business. But let's say you decide, I get it. I understand what life's about. And I understand that I have a few short years on this planet. I am here to grow, to change. And at the end of my days, I will be standing in front of Hashem and I will be for eternity what I made myself into. So what you start doing is the right things. You start learning, you start doing chesed, you start davening, you start doing all the right things. Your nefesh ha-sichli becomes stronger and stronger, your nefesh ha-bahami becomes weaker and weaker, and sichli becomes stronger, nefesh ha-bahami becomes weaker, until you reach a point that the nefesh ha-bahami, your animal instincts and drives, have very, very little control. They've now gone from 50-50, they've become 10, the nefesh ha-sichli is now a 90, and now you're ready to accomplish your mission on this planet. However, that's the problem. You see, the human was put on the planet to grow. And growth, by definition, means there has to be a challenge. There has to be temptation, there has to be desire, and there has to be the anochi, the I, saying no. I'm the master of my ship, and I am in charge, and I won't do that. You see, that's the whole purpose of creation. For the I to stand up and say, I am in charge here, for me to resist the temptation, for me to resist the challenge, that's the growth, that's the real human being coming to the fore. And if you get to the point where your nefesh ha-bahami is very, very weak and your seichel is very, very strong, there's almost no point in life because you've arrived. But if you have arrived at 20 years of age or 30 years of age, you have a big problem because there's no more growth. And if you'd like to understand this Chazal, it's really a very simple concept. Rabbi Saul says, we've discussed this a number of times in previous Shmuzim. The soul says there are two distinct Yetzaharas. There's a Nefesh HaBahami, the desires, base instincts, needs within the human. And then there's a separate Yetzahara unrelated to the first. There's a Yetzahara that's a Malach, that's the Satan. And the Satan is allowed to induce and use certain forces. If you'd like to understand what this Chazal is saying, it's really quite simple. When a man reaches 90% nefesh ha-sichli, 10% nefesh ha-bahami, there's a problem in the mix. There's no challenge, no desire. Hence, the sultan is allowed out of the box. The sultan is allowed more power. The sultan is allowed to increase desires. The sultan is allowed to put more magnetism into the drive. So if the man has a set point of 10 or 15 in taiva, or even if he decreased it further, it was only 5, the sultan is allowed a little more electricity, the electromagnet becomes stronger and stronger, and he can increase it, until again it's an even balance. So if his nefesh ha-sichli is a 90, it's up here, and the sultan is allowed to add more power to the nefesh ha-bahami until it's equal, the drive increases, the need increases, the hunger increases, until again it's an even battle. And my friends, what that means in plain language is really simple. You ever hear the words, oh, if only I had a gadol yetzahara. Hey, what did they want to do? Just want to learn and do mitzvahs. And Rabosai, with all due respect, if we had a gadol yetzahara, we'd be serial killers. We'd be out there murdering, killing, raping, pillaging, who knows what. Because when a person is really that great, the satan is allowed more power, more influence, more energy, and the balance is again equal. Now, with that being said, I think we're ready to answer the question. The question was, how could Rav Ashi say the words Menashe? Why were you so foolish? And then Menashe answers back, if you were in my generation, you would have done the same. And the answer really is quite simple. The Marshal explains that this was at the time before the destruction of Taiva for Avodah Zarah. The Gemara in Sanhedrin explains to us that once upon a time, there was a physical pull that a person had to serve idols. There was a lusting, a desire, there was a huge urge within the human to serve Avodah Zarah. Something that we can't even relate to, something we can't even identify. But if you could imagine at that time, there was a drive, there was a desire. I guess if you'd find high school guys, they'd have magazine pictures of this Avodah Zarah. Hey, look at this Avodah. Oh, wow, you got to see my Baal Peor. It's unbelievable. Because it was a taiva for Avodah Zarah. That's been eradicated. The Anshei Knesset Agdola asked that be eradicated. But at those times, it existed. And what that means in plain, simple language is, had we lived in the time of Menashe, we would have been pulled towards Avodah Zarah. And when we're pulled towards Avodah Zarah, it's not just a pulling of the heart. A pulling of the heart changes your mind as well. And if you desire something, it's not just a passion, a need, a hunger. It changes your mindset, changes the way you view things, and you look at things differently. No longer would we say, what stupidity, bowing down to a piece of wood and bowing to the star, the sun, the moon, what nonsense. There would have been an allure. There would have been a real luster to it. Wow, I wish I could bow down. I realize how great it is. Unfortunately, I'm bound by the Torah not to. Hashem told me not to, but I wish I could serve that Avodah Zarah. And as strange as it sounds, what Menashe was saying to Rav Ashi was quite simple. Had you been around in our time, the pull was so powerful, it would have changed your heart. It would have changed your mind. You would have been running after Avodah Zarah like the rest of us. And Menashe did not refute him. When Rav Ashi heard those words, Rav Ashi not only agreed to them, but Rav Ashi called him our Rebbe, someone who's greater than we. But he was born in that generation and failed that Nisayan. And my friends, I believe that there are two huge chidushim from this Chazal. The first chiddush is that our minds are greatly influenced by what we desire. What Rav Chanan is saying is, the mitzvah of emunah is, divorce yourself from the what ifs. What if I believe in Hashem? What if I accept this as true? What does that mean? Divorce yourself from the consequences and your mind will tell you exactly the reality. The difficulty is, it's very hard to divorce my thinking from my heart. And when I believe, I desire, what I need affects my belief. What I hunger for affects the way I look at things. And when you see a young man doing something in the shidduch scene that sounds ludicrous and ridiculous, you're watching a person who's being pulled by his heart and it changes his mind. But the second kiddush, I think, is equally important. That second kiddush is that desire, across the gamut of desire, can change, be increased and decreased. Just like seasonally in the animal kingdom, there could be a greater desire in the months of May and June. Just like there could be various places that will pull much more, so too there could be different generations when there are different desires. There could be a generation when there's a pull towards Avodah Zarah. There could be a generation when there's a huge, huge pull towards certain beliefs. And there could be a generation where there could be a pull towards Taiva, and there could even be a generation where pulls of belief can make you do things that are utterly ridiculous and difficult to understand. And I'd like to share with you one example of that that I believe we're sort of experiencing in our own times. And to do that, let me share with you something very interesting. In a previous shmuz, we discussed a mussar exercise. The mussar exercise that I mentioned in that shmuz was the following. If you take your hand and clench it, open it and clench it, open it and clench it, open it and clench it 100 times, I believe that is a huge, huge mussar lesson. Why? Because if you're physically fit, by about 50 or 60, you'll feel your muscles starting to fatigue. By 70 or 80, if you're doing it quickly, rapidly, and hard, you'll start losing your ability to really grip. And somewhere around 90, you realize that this is a very hard thing to keep doing. And then I want you to think the following. Your heart is a muscle about the size of your fist, and it beats 100,000 times a day. Day after day, day after day, but it doesn't stop. And you have to ask yourself, gee golly, that's pretty impressive. My hand, and everyone always tries it as I do this, everyone tries it in the back, but they never really do it right. Open fast, open fast, open fast. You mean, keep in mind, your heart pumps. There are two sides to your heart. The left side, the right side. The left side pumps the blood into your lungs. The right side pumps the blood into the rest of your body all day long, every second, beating, beating, beating. Why doesn't it fatigue? It doesn't fatigue because it's made out of different sort of muscles than other muscles of your forearm. It's made of cardiac tissue. Cardiac muscle is made of different sort of protein structures, and therefore it doesn't fatigue, and it beats on and on. However, the real lesson isn't the heart, because the heart is only relevant because it brings the blood to the rest of your body. And the blood, I think, is something that is a fascinating concept. You see, what blood does is it brings things throughout your body. It brings oxygen, it brings nutrients, it removes waste, and it brings over 200 vital substances throughout your body. It's constantly moving things from one place to another, taking oxygen from the lungs, bringing it to the cells, taking waste from the cells, bringing it to the excretory system, bringing things back and forth. It's kind of like the UPS of the body. Now, what's amazing about it is, despite the fact that it's delivering things all day long, it's on autopilot. Meaning, UPS has a whole tier level. There are drivers who are intelligent and watching out that things don't go wrong. There are middle-level managers who make sure that the drivers are on schedule. There are upper-level management that make sure all the various regions are doing their pieces in synchronized format. There's fully upper-level management. There's even a CEO who's watching the full ship. But if you didn't have that hierarchy, it would cease to exist. No one is paying attention to the blood. No one is paying attention to the UPS system. It's bringing, taking all day long. However, it's not just the blood. You see, the blood requires many things. In the lungs, oxygen is put in. In the spleen, various waste products are taken out. In the kidney, various other waste products are taken out, but the kidney does something else. It checks the oxygen level. Is there enough oxygen in the blood? If not, the kidney signals the bone marrow to produce more red blood cells. Red blood cells are that which carries the oxygen. The bone marrow produces a few million red blood cells every second, each one delivered, each one put into the right place. By the way, anyone know how to make a red blood cell? But if you're not impressed yet, let's start understanding the very fascinating part. What happens when you get a cut? Right? You're cutting an apple and accidentally you cut your finger. A very interesting thing happens. You bleed. But it doesn't matter if you cut your finger or your hand or your arm or your head or your shin or your back or your stomach. Wherever you cut, shallow or deep, if you lacerate the skin, you bleed. Do you know why that is? It's really quite simple. Because what the blood does is it brings the nutrients to the level of activity in the body. All real action in the body happens on the cellular level. Well, the problem is you got a whole mess of cells in your body. And that means throughout your body, every part of your body has to have blood flowing to it and then taking the waste products away, bringing stuff in and bringing stuff out. To accomplish this wonder of bringing blood to every single part and section of your body, there are 60,000 miles of capillaries, a network that's hard to imagine how vast, how wide, how spread out it is throughout every organ, every muscle, every tissue in your body, because every live cell requires nourishment and nutrient, and somehow, within the embryo of the baby, forms the heart with the two chambers, pumping, the entire artery, vein system, and the 60,000 miles of capillaries form. The heart begins beating at 4 weeks of age. By 8 weeks of age, it's fully functional, and that forms without anyone watching, without anyone paying attention. However, here's the more interesting part. The heart beats up here in your chest. If you have capillaries throughout the entire body, how does the blood get there? The heart is only so strong and can only beat so much. How do you get the blood down to every single last capillary? Well, it happens to be that the arteries themselves beat along in time. So that when you're running, it's not just that your heart that picks up. Your heart increases the blood pressure and the speed. The arteries increase their pressure and their speed. And the entire system goes into overdrive from the heart to the arteries, pumping, a pressurized circulation system. And here we come to the point. How is it that when you get cut, your blood doesn't just drip away? There are only roughly 5 quarts of blood in your body. Imagine that you have for a minute, it's not even that much really, it's 5 liters. So imagine for a minute that you have your 2 liter Coke bottle, you have about 2.5 of them. Imagine that you have one on the table and a little pinhole is formed in the bottom. The Coke starts dripping, 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 dripping. The size of the hole determine how quickly, but after not a long time, all the Coke that was in the bottle is going to be on the floor. How is it that when you scrape your shin, when you cut your finger, you don't just bleed to death? And if that question doesn't amaze you, those aren't the dangerous cuts. It's the internal injuries that are far more dangerous. You see, if you cut your finger, you could put a Band-Aid on. You could apply pressure. You could stop the blood flow. What happens when you get a black and blue mark? Internally, veins, arteries, capillaries have been broken, and the blood is spreading. You get many, many internal injuries that you're unaware of. How is it that it stops? So we're all familiar with something that we take for granted. It's called the clotting system. The clotting system in man, as the rest of the, most of the animal kingdom, is really quite simple. First, a clot forms, the platelets begin forming a clot, then the clot hardens, and then it heals over and the wound is gone. And now, I'd like to share with you something that I consider fascinating. Everyone would love to be king, right? What's better than king? Oh, if only I could be king, all the power, no responsibility, I could be the real, real ultimate despot. Amazingly, in the 19th and 20th century, many, many people would not dare marry into the royal families. And it began with Queen Victoria, because Queen Victoria had a son named Leopold. And Leopold was very, very delicate. So delicate, in fact, that a mere scratch could threaten his life. His entire life, he had to be watched carefully. He had to be guarded and protected because he was a hemophiliac. And what that meant, quite simply, is that any cut in his body would bleed, just like you and I, but it would continue bleeding, and continue bleeding, continue, and continue, until all of the blood, 2.5 liters in his body, would drain out, be on the floor, and he'd be dead. But the real danger, again, was not external injuries. The real danger was internal hemorrhaging. And despite the fact that he had to be watched so carefully, he died at a young age. But it wasn't just Leopold. Queen Victoria, who had been known as the mother of the monarchy, also spread her genes to Spain, to Russia, to Germany, and much of the royal household had this curse called hemophilia, and many people would not dream of marrying into the royal family because the blood was tainted. But here's the interesting thing. What was lacking? Platelets, he had. Blood, he certainly had. What was lacking that Leopold died young? Many of the crown princes died at a tender age, despite the fact they had what seems like exactly what you and I had. And I'd like to share with you what's known as the clotting cascade to appreciate the wonders of Hashem's world. When you get a cut, what happens is very interesting. First, the platelets, which are not that many, begin forming right around the cut. But what creates the clot? What stops them from all just spilling out? And what happens is a very intricate process. There is a protein called fibrinogen. Now, you'll excuse me if I don't pronounce these correctly. I've never heard them in my youth, and I've read about them a number of times, but they are rather strange-sounding enzymes and proteins, so you'll forgive me if I mispronounce them. But fibrinogen is a long molecule. It's actually a protein, and what happens is it floats around your blood, seemingly harmlessly, just hanging out, doing nothing, until there's a cut. And when there's a cut in any part of your tissue, what happens is there's another protein, thrombin, that comes and trims off little ends of the fibrinogen. Imagine you have this little protein about this, it's actually nowhere near this long, but imagine for a minute it's long. This thrombin acts on parts of the fibrinogen, cuts off little sections, so now this long protein has sticky parts to it. Another fibrinogen, which also was acted upon by thrombin, which also had parts seared off, is now sticking at parts. So these two fibrinogens now will stick to each other. another one, another one, another one, another one. Before you know it, many of them stick together and you have what looks like a fisherman's net. Just the right size to catch the platelets. The platelets come against the fisherman's net. They start binding and binding and they make a little plug. And that little plug begins hardening. That hardened plug then heals over and you have the solution to why we don't bleed to death. However, here's the mystery. In your body right now as we speak, you have much fibrinogen. You have much thrombin. Why is it that right now as we speak, why doesn't it just sear off the ends of those fibrinogen so that the fibrinogen becomes sticky and then there's a clot right in your arteries, your veins, and your heart, in your anywhere in the circulatory system? Why does it just happen now? So the answer is there's a third piece that has to be involved. That's called Stewart factor. You see, thrombin itself is inert in the sense that it cannot change fibrinogen until Stewart factor affects it. Once Stewart factor is active and changes thrombin to become now active, it can now act on fibrinogen. Now, as these words, this is going to sound like chad gadya, because Stewart factor alone is not active. See, if it was active, it would act on the thrombin. The thrombin would act on the fibrinogen. There has to be another enzyme that makes thrombin active. But there has to be another one to make it active. There has to be another one to make... There's a cascade of 20 different proteins, each one acting on the other, on the other, on the other. And you know what hemophilia is about? Factor 8. In that 20-long chain, one little enzyme, I don't know what it's called. In fact, it's called factor 8. It doesn't even have a name because the names are so strange. Factor 8 is missing and the person bleeds to death. As a matter of fact, until recent times, hemophilia was a fatal disease. People died typically at very young ages and rarely made it out of childhood. And if you're not quite appreciative of what this is about yet, I wanted to fully understand this. So I took a little demonstration. I'm going to show you this. If you can see this, this is a play of the 20 different enzymes. It's a cascade. One causes another, which causes another, which causes another, which causes another. Now, if it doesn't seem complex enough to you, let me share with you something. I took a typical play from an NFL playbook, and I put it over here. Pretty simple. And then I compared it to the rather multiple times complex cascade of clotting. And I realized that, gee golly, these professional football players are trained and practiced time after time. You go left, you go right, you go here, you go. And they rarely get it right. Yet time after time, cut your finger, cut your arm, cut your... Every time, time after time, cascade of 20 different proteins do exactly what they should do, and they stop exactly when they should stop. And then you say to yourself, oh my goodness, I get it. It's remarkable. Irreducibly complex. It can't function without every piece in place. It could not possibly evolve. There's no explanation other than a brilliant, wise creator put this into place so that the human should not bleed to death. Now, would you like to know where I got much of this information from? From a textbook on evolution? That's correct. You got it. You see, evolutionary theory has to answer this problem. They can't answer it, but they do try. And if you would like to read a wonderful book, quite a difficult read, but B wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. And in it, he describes many processes, one of which is clotting, and he describes that it's almost impossible. He's a biochemist. It's almost impossible to explain to a layman the complications of the system, how complex, how involved. And you'll read many, many books written by evolutionists who try to deal with it. And at a certain point, you have to say to yourself, what are you thinking? Is there an answer? There is no answer. But that's exactly the answer. If you do not want to see something, if you do not want to believe, if you start with a bias, God is not part of my world. God is not part of nature and God can't exist. Then any answer will suffice, any answer will do, and worst case scenario, we have no answer. But you see, that default position is exactly the start and end point. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from this discussion between Rav Ashi and Menashe. What Rav Ashi said to Menashe is, you're a brilliant man. You know halachas that I don't know. How could you have been so foolish as to follow Avodah Zarah? Menashe's answer back was, it was different times. There was a taiva, there was a drive, there was a desire for Avodah Zarah in our time. that didn't just change the way you felt about things, it changed the way you look at things. Watch a young man who falls in love and understands, she'll change, she'll be different. When we get married, she'll be happy and she'll be a different human being. Right. And as foolish as it sounds to you and I, when you're in that moment, it doesn't sound ridiculous, it doesn't sound foolish, because what you believe in is greatly influenced by your desires, by your needs, by your appetites and hungers. And that is what Menashe said to Rav Ashi. Right now you're cool and dispassionate. It doesn't concern you, Avodah Zarah. You see it as ludicrous. Had you been in my time, you would have seen it as something you desired, something you wanted, and you would have believed in it. And as ridiculous as it sounds, I think it's very, very true. When Chazal say, Misha Godlo Mechavero Yitzro Godlo Mechavero, one is greater than his friend, his desires are greater. What that means quite simply is his nefesh abahami became very, very weakened. He's a person who grew, who accomplished. He changed his nefesh sikhli to a 90, nefesh abahami to a 10, but there's no balance there. There's no challenge of life. So the sultan is allowed to give more energy. He's allowed to turn on an electromagnet. He's allowed to give more energy to it, and there's more of a pull in that person. Just like desires are seasonal, just like desires can be influenced by places, so too, depending on your level, there can be a greater pull, a greater desire. And the huge, huge chiddush is, whatever you desire changes your way of looking at things, changes what you believe in, changes the way you approach things. When you see the human body, the greatest revelation of Hashem's brilliance, and people study it and say, whatever, it evolved, you understand exactly this point. And let me close on a point that I mentioned in a previous shmooze, but it bears repeating. When you're involved in computer science, you understand that projects take a lot longer than you wish they would. And they began measuring computer programs by the tens of hours, and by the hundreds of hours, by the thousands of hours, and that became insufficient. Because they quickly recognize that programs that are built on top of programs, on top of programs, on top of programs, when you buy a product like Microsoft Word, we're not dealing with hours, we're dealing with man years. How many man years does it take to write the program? The first version of Internet Explorer took 3,000 man years to write. Because all of the coding was built on previous coding, built on previous coding. They needed teams and teams of writers to program it, to write it, so that it should all function perfectly. One of the most amazing accomplishments of the human race is sending a man into space. The amount of intricate parts that had to work together, besides the life support system, besides all the various radar, besides the flight system, besides everything involved, all of the computers, they estimated that within those probes, the amount of man years to write the programming was somewhere around 22,000 years. It took a team, teams and teams, 22,000 man years to write all of the coding to keep three astronauts alive on their short journey to the moon. And here's the thought for the day. The embryo has not a 3-day journey, but a 9-month stay in its mother's womb. 9 months during which it changes radically. 9 months during which it goes from being a egg cell, a sperm cell, to a fully formed baby. If you would like to know the complexity of those systems, one small organ would require 22,000 years of programming for it to function. The cloning system would require far more, but all of that forms. And if you ask any scientist in the world to compare the complexity of a live human baby to a space probe, they would say to you, there's no basis for comparison. A baby is so far more complex. The systems, the wisdom that's in there operating is millions of times more complex than the greatest accomplishment of man. And when you understand that, what you immediately say is, I get it. There's a creator. There's a Borei Olam who made this, put that wisdom in, and you say the words, oh my goodness, Hashem, I see your hand in the Bria. And yet, as ridiculous as it sounds, many, many people stare at that, discuss it, tell you details that you never knew about it, all the while saying, whatever, it evolved, it happened. And my friends, there is a huge lesson for us, not just in how to approach others, but the huge lesson is how to approach ourselves. Because once I understand that my desires, my interests pull me, and I understand that I'm invalid in terms of judging myself, and I also understand why it's so difficult for me to see Hashem's presence. If I were to train my eye to see the wisdom in the world, I would see Hashem in a flower, I would see Hashem in a spring, I would see Hashem in every particle of this world. But you have to train yourself to get out of that locked-in mode of acceptance, and you have to work on it. When you do, you see a vastly changing, powerful world and constant revelations of Hashem's hand. Hashem grant us the wisdom, understanding, ability to put this into practice.